Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and our rotating team of program hosts. This week, our host is Chris Kington Barker, and because our program is live today, we do invite you to be part of today's discussion with your calls at 805-781-3875. Or, as always, you can email your questions after the program to voices@kcbx.org. Now, with that, let's join Chris and her guests. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. Trans women and teens have come under fire over the past years in a topic often associated with women and girls sports. This lopsided focus on trans people, who make up approximately 1% of the population, is demonstrated by the estimated 745 anti-trans bills that were introduced in the state legislatures across the country by March 15th, 2025. Even though many Americans are more directly impacted by issues such as rising costs and lack of affordable housing, my guests are here today to talk about this and the steps they've been taking locally to bring an understanding about issues facing transgender students while addressing facts over fear. I'm joined by Dr. Denise Taylor, HIV specialist and gender-affirming care provider, and Trevor Norcross, father and advocate of a transgender teen daughter. And I want to welcome both of you, Trevor and Dr. Taylor. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I think it'll be a little bit helpful if we have a little background about how you got into the field that you're in right now, for you, Dr. Taylor, and Trevor, for you, how this really became a passion for you. So, Dr. Taylor, you know, how long have you been involved in transgender care or gender-affirming care?
Yeah. So I've been doing gender-affirming care for about 25 years. I started during my time out at the California Men's Colony. There was a change in policy for CDCR the year 1999 due to a lawsuit, and so CDCR was mandated to start providing hormone therapy for transgender inmates, and there were no specialist out at the prison, and so I decided to take it on instead of having an outside endocrinologist come in, because it sounded like an interesting topic to me. And so I educated myself and started taking care of transgender inmates, transgender women. At the same time, I started working in San Luis Obispo community, first at the county clinics, and then that later morphed into the community health centers. And I opened up the clinic because I was doing HIV care there, and started seeing transgender patients in the community, because I figured there were probably a couple of people in the community who might benefit from my expertise that I had developed out at CMC. So here we are 25 years later, and we recently did an audit of how many patients I'm seeing. And in the last 3 years, I've seen more than 300 people. Individual people on an ongoing basis, and 70 of those are under 18. So we can see that the need was much greater than I anticipated. Yeah. 25 years ago, when I thought, oh, there's probably one or two or three people out in the community who might want to come in, and the need was much greater than that.
And yep. you're seeing people not only from this county, but people are coming from other areas to seek care.
Yeah, over the years, there's been an increase in gender-affirming care providers, but mm-hmm. I would say probably, 15 years ago, I was seeing patients from Fresno, from Bakersfield, from Ventura, Santa Barbara, coming down from not so much from Monterey, but like King City, because mm-hmm. I was kind of the only person around who was doing it for that radius of patients. So they would drive 2-3 hours each way just to come here to get gender-affirming care that was friendly and accepting and not judgmental.
And you've more recently been kind of collaborating with Trevor on doing some community presentations about some of the misunderstandings, the myths, the issues that are surrounding transgender care and transgender impossible in general.
Yeah, so we've been approaching various groups who want to get more information. I feel like I bring the science, the experience, the medical side to debunk a lot of the myths or, you know, answer questions about the medical care. Trevor and his family are having the lived experience. I really feel like they are the important ones in this story because
right.
they're the ones who are really living through this. I bring more of a, yeah, just I think the years of experience having taken care of, at this point, several hundred transgender people. And all the different stories that they have been telling me.
And just to note, when you talk about you're practicing 300 patients, that's just your practice
right.
the area. There are other providers that are seeing patients as well. And it's just a reminder, you know, I don't know how many, you know, what our population here is in the county. It's got to be over 100,000 people. You know, the transgender community is estimated to be 1%, so you would think it's somewhere in that 1,000-person range.
Right. Right. So, Trevor, talk a little bit about your family and your journey here from beginning until you got here. Your daughter is trans.
Yes, my daughter is trans. And it was something that we never expected. You know, our daughter was finally able to tell us who she's always been a little over 2 years ago when she was just turned 15. And that was right before her freshman year in high school. So when my wife and I, you know, I found a note in the morning that our daughter had left for us, and I read it and brought it into my wife. And so when our daughter came out that morning, we hugged her and said, "We love you. We're going to have a lot of questions because we're not familiar, but we love you, and we will always love you and always support you." So it's been a learning since then. I've always considered myself an ally to the LGBTQ community, but I've never really had an interaction with a trans person in my life. It's just knowingly, I should say,
right?
Because there aren't that many people. And I think that's part of the issue and why I emphasize knowingly, because as I've gotten to know the community and working with lots of different organizations and meeting more trans people, I'm shocked over and over again when I'm talking to somebody and then they tell me they're trans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what do you mean? There is no look of being trans.
Right.
So it's been a fascinating journey. It's a journey and experience that I wouldn't wish on anybody in this current environment, because it's a community under attack. So it's stressful. It's just crazy. Every day you wake up and are learning more about, you know, what laws are trying to be passed, or, you know, what's going on in the government, and how they're just vilifying a very, very small population.
When your daughter came out to you as being trans, you and your wife, had you been very LGBT positive and someone who had supported the LGBTQ community openly for her so that she could see that there was, you know, the potential that she was going to be embraced as someone who was okay?
Yeah. So I grew up in Oro Grande and left when I went to college, and we were able to come back about 11 years ago. And we've got friends in the area that are in the LGBT community. We would go to Pride when she was young. You know, we would watch shows that were inclusive on television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was, you know, we just exposed her to reality.
Right.
Is what we did. But she still, didn't have the words to know what was going on within her until she was, you know, 15. And we could see in the years, about 2 years before she told us, we could see her shrinking, you know, that she was kind of pulling away and not being as outgoing as she was. And, you know, we knew there was something going on, but she just wasn't able to tell us what was happening. So when she finally did, I was like, okay, now we can help support her.
When you say shrinking, it was pulling back from the persona that she had previously.
Yeah.
And you noticed that.
Yeah.
What was the response from your friends and from people around you when your daughter came out and you embraced that?
Mostly positive, but there was some mixed. You know, mm-hmm. there were a lot of acquaintances that kind of, you know, backed off. And you know, they would say, well, you know, we just don't have any experience with that. It's like, well, we don't either. there were some folks that distanced themselves a little bit. You know, our other close friends, you know, had their own questions as well. And, you know, we have helped them learn and create that exposure. But, you know, family and close friends have always been supportive. But it definitely been mixed. And it's one of those things, as we would tell people, the constant thing that I would hear is, well, she's really lucky to have you guys as parents.
Mm-hmm.
And my retort was always, you're saying the quiet part out loud, because what you're admitting to is most of these kids don't have that support.
Yeah.
So as we've gone through this and had, you know, all the issues at the school boards and all that kind of stuff, when we speak and engage with the community, it's to protect our daughter, but it's also to speak for those other kids that don't have anybody to speak for them.
Right, right. There's, you know, I want to bring up one thing that comes up that's a negative about that is, what about the people that say, and either of you can answer this, that the reason that your daughter has decided that she's trans is because she was exposed to all of these open thinking and the fact that she could go to Gay Pride and go, that she was, you know, more or less being brainwashed into something that a young mind can't handle. Did you ever hear that?
No one's, I mean, we hear that
out there,
out, you know, out in the community and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, as kind of one of those myths. If anybody knows what we've gone through and what our daughter has gone through and what these kids go through, I can't imagine anybody choosing to do this.
Yeah.
You know, this, you know, I've talked to school board members that, you know, are not supportive, and, you know, had conversations with them as well. You know, one of them would say that, you know, being gay or being trans is a choice. And I'm like, So are you choosing to be straight? And of course, the answer is, well, of course not. Mm-hmm. It's like, then why do you not? It's like, why should I believe you that you say that you're not making a choice if you're not willing to believe somebody else saying they're not making a choice? Just because it's not your lived experience doesn't mean that it's not real.
And your daughter's in her role as a she.
Yes.
As her. Is she come out of her shrinking?
Oh, my God. After she told us, I had a business trip in San Francisco. So I was out, and my wife took her shopping for clothes. And I saw some of the pictures afterwards, and the smile that was there was incredible to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. People ask me, you know, often a question is, you know, how do we know people are trans? You know,
right.
Is there a test? How do we know this is a thing? And I think, you know, what Trevor just said is something I have observed over the 25 years of doing this, is people coming in, you know, and their heads are bowed down. They won't make eye contact. They're fearful of what I might say, that it might be something harmful. Their hair's in their eyes. And over the year, you know, after they get the treatment that's appropriate for them, you know, I do see the smile come up. You know, they're more engaged. They're looking me in the eyes, and you see the confidence. And that's how I know we're on the right track. Because, you know, my job as a physician is to make sure that people have the best quality of life as they define it, not as how I define it or the world defines it, and as long as it's within safe parameters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, people choose to treat or not treat. Diabetes, high blood pressure, whatever, you know. I'm not there to make people do anything. I'm there to educate and tell them what's safe and what the likely outcomes are going to be, what the likely side effects might be, and they make decisions for themselves. But this is something so profoundly personal that it's really for them to define for themselves. But and occasionally someone comes in and I tell every patient when they start, I say, this may not be for you. You have an idea that this hormone is going to help you feel better, and, you know, be open to the idea that it might not. Doesn't mean you're not trans. It just means this is not part of your journey, part of your pathway, because every person has a different journey. Not everyone has surgery. Not everyone takes medications. They don't all take the same medications at the same doses. But what is important is that it improves their quality of life, gives them confidence to interact in the world.
And you maintain contact with your patients?
Yes, patients come in every 3 to 6 months generally. This is an ongoing treatment. It is monitored. You know, there are standards of care that are used worldwide. There are professional organizations around this. So this is this is medical care that's recognized by all the legitimate professional medical associations and is recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics and by the AMA and by family practice medical groups. And so this idea that this is some sort of fringe treatment that's not legitimate somehow is just completely false.
Well, and these are the same medications that these kids are taking are used for other purposes as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's no special transgender medication that isn't already used for other people. So they've been used safely for decades. And so there's, you know, very good knowledge about how these medications are going to affect people.
And I think there's also a myth that, you know, like if our daughter, you know, came out to us and, you know, told us who she's always been, that the next day they're on medications and you know, those types of things. It's like, no, that's not the way it happens. As a parent, you know, we had lots of questions. We were in the dark and we were paranoid and had all the questions that anybody would have, you know, is this real? Is this who she really
is? Is
this
a phase? Is this,
you know, her friend group was, this is like, that's no longer a friend group. I mean, it was not an inclusive group. So it's like, there is no influence there. You know, you work with medical providers, therapists, psychiatrists, you know, there's a whole group of support and process and protocols that you go through. Because the parents have a journey as well to figure out what's going on. And, man, we had a ton of questions.
And the parents have a say
because
they have to agree. I have a consent form that they – both parents or any legal guardian that has a say in their care has to sign. So I've had cases where one parent is accepting and maybe there's a parent who doesn't live with the family but still has some sort of parental rights. I said, well, until that parent signs, I cannot provide this medication to this patient unless they're 18. So this idea that kids are getting, you know, treatment at school or that somehow they're just going in and getting treatment willy-nilly is completely false. And then also with surgeries, generally surgeries are reserved for adults, so over 18. There may be the occasional surgery that might be necessary for someone under 18, but those are very well thought out. There has to be mental health evaluations. Again, parents have to agree. So this idea that a lot of this legislation is trying to take away the rights of transgender youth to receive care, this is actually against the parental, you know, desire of their, or, you know, rights of the patients to agree to this care. So, you know, they talk about parental rights a lot from the conservative side, and but apparently it doesn't matter when it comes to health care in this instance.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices. I'm Chris King-DeBarker. The voices with me are Dr. Denise Taylor, HIV specialist and gender-affirming care provider, Trevor Norcross, father and advocate of a transgender teen daughter, and we're discussing Facts Over Fear, understanding issues facing transgender students. We invite you to bring your questions to these two individuals that can answer them at 805-781-3875. What were some of the biggest questions that you had, Trevor, when you shared this information for your daughter? What were some of the most frightening questions that you had?
I think the first thing that was just fear for her.
Yeah.
You know, we knew it's like this is going to make life hard. This is not an easy path.
She was not in a group of friends that were LGBTQ youths, right?
Right.
So this really was out of the blue.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, we can look back and say, oh, well, maybe, yeah, you know, there were some things that we can go back and question and say, you know, maybe there were some clues along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to, you know, make, I'm very purposeful, and my wife, Hillary, helped me kind of figure this out. You know, when we talk about our daughter, we talk about her telling us who she's always been.
Mm. Can you explain that?
Because, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about this, they think there's some type of change.
Yeah, like a switch.
Like a switch.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they've changed who they are type thing.
Right.
You know, when they, you know, go through the social transition and changing names and that kind of stuff. And what we have learned and what we have experienced is that, no, this is who they've always been.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't always have the words or the understanding to be able to communicate that.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids do. You know, some kids are 5 and 6 and, you know, espousing, you know, this is who I am. You know, and
even at that age.
At that age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's persistent and consistent. As well, you know, there's a consistency in that expression. So it's, you know, those were the fears and concerns that we had. You know, we heard all the stuff, you know, from both sides as well, and had our own questions like, okay, how do we sort this out? What's real? Because this is our child,
mm-hmm,
that we're talking about. This is not something that you go into lightly. You know, this is us panicked and working with each other and working with the medical providers and the team to really understand. And, you know, as they talked to our daughter, they were like, the last thing that we would ever doubt is who your daughter is based on what she's telling us and how she presents herself.
Mm-hmm.
So there was never any question from anybody in any medical professional capacity as they got to know our daughter.
Is your daughter an only child? Or
yes.
She's an only child?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was she athletic?
Yeah, she was running track and cross country in junior high,
okay,
and she's been running on the track team at high school,
okay,
and that's what, you know, caused the big uproar after the current administration's inauguration. We had a local church that organized, and, you know, they created a culture impact ministry within Harvest Church, and met, and they advertised a movie night where they showed a documentary from Turning Point USA and Daily Wire of an adult that detransitioned, and had a conversation after that talking about what's going on in our community, and didn't name our daughter, but identified our daughter based on being at the high school and being on the track team. There's an N of one. I attended that movie night and sat in the back and didn't engage, but just listened. And they showed up at the next – they were looking for speakers to go to the school board meeting, adults and students. And the next school board meeting is when they had a student that was also on the track team that ran long distance versus being a sprinter like our daughter, that made a comment that went viral. And then they took that clip and pushed it to Trump and to Riley Gaines and to all the right-wing influencers out there to get traction, and the student ended up doing national interviews on Fox News and other right-wing
media channels. So your daughter became someone who was targeted during the campaign.
After he was inaugurated.
After he was inaugurated.
Yeah.
As a transgender youth.
Athlete.
Who was an athlete.
Yes. Yes.
How painful that must have been.
It was otherworldly.
I can imagine.
You know, being at the – because we were – after our daughter – this was her sophomore year. So after our daughter came out in her freshman year, I was attending all school board meetings. When she told us who she's always been, I contacted folks at the school and was like, what are we in for? And they would always tell us, you know, that the school is a safe place. And I would always say, yeah, but you can't protect the hallways. So her freshman year, her administrator would meet with her on a weekly basis to hear about what's going on, bullying incidences, you know, all those types of things. So when this student made the comment at the school board meeting about our daughter being in the locker room and an accusation of her watching girls change, I went in the next day and talked to the principal and the administration and said, that's the first I'm hearing of this. Did they bring this accusation to the school? And they were very clear in saying, yes, they did. A parent called in claiming that there was a boy in the girls' locker room, but there was no accusation of watching girls change. It was just the fact of somebody being in the locker room. They were corrected to be, you know, a transgender girl in the locker room. So the story had changed when it got to the school board meeting, or was amended in from what the school was aware of. Because we were used to getting phone calls all the time if there was anything going on. You know, her freshman year, because they take PE as a freshman and a sophomore, there was a rumor that she was talking about boobs and butts. And the administration called us immediately. It's like, this is a rumor. It's completely unfounded. You know, we see the videos of people entering and exiting the locker rooms, and we have an adult monitor in the locker room that knows exactly when she's there and when she's not. And all of them are like, this is nothing that we've ever seen. You know, we can't substantiate that at all.
So what started as a transition that was supposedly going to be supported by the school and supported by parents with lots of questions blew up. And blew up into all kinds of myths,
right,
and anxieties, and just exploded with, is it Lily?
Yeah.
With Lily in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
We have a question from John. I know we have your question, John. We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll come back to your question in just a minute.
Hola, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Every Thursday afternoon at 2, you can hear Latino USA on KCBX. Latino USA is a Peabody Award-winning radio journal of news and culture from a Latino-Latina perspective. It chronicles how we're living, shaping, and changing the United States of America. Tune in for in-depth reporting, candid conversations, and fascinating stories. Join me for Latino USA Thursdays from 2 to 3 on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
It's our 50th anniversary on the air, and KCBX listeners are sharing the love.
My name is Bob Clark. KCBX has programming for every part of your brain. The intellectual part, the emotional part, and the moving and grooving part. There is something for every part of your brain, and anytime you want. The DJs are great. They're local. They're really knowledgeable. They have so much institutional knowledge about music. And it's fascinating to listen to them interject in between songs. And the songs they pick out are also just fabulous. Things I would never do on my own. It's been a great part of the community. They seem to know a lot about what's going on around here, and they keep us informed. It's just a great radio station. I'm really glad it's been around. You know, I really love donating to KCBX. I think my money goes far when I donate to KCBX.
Show your support with a donation at kcbx.org.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist John le Carré's son, Nick Harkaway, tells us about bringing back his late father's spy master, George Smiley, and Harkaway's latest novel, Carla's Choice. It takes place between le Carré's Cold War spy novels, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Join us.
That is a look ahead today on our Thursday here on KCBX, where you can hear Fresh Air coming up at 3 after Latino USA. Then it's Marketplace at 4 and All Things Considered at 4:30. Right now, let's rejoin Chris Kington Barker and her guests on Central Coast Public Radio for Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. I'm Chris Kington Barker, back with you for the second half of this show. We're going to be continuing with Trevor and Dr. Taylor, but we want to take a call from John. John, are you there? John?
Oh, hi.
Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
John?
Yes.
Okay, I can hear you now. You were really low for a minute. But hi, you have a question?
I have a lot of them. I don't understand this this situation that, you know, I can go from so many different angles. Having gone to school in a number of different schools growing up, I saw different people and always felt sort of an acceptance of whoever they were. And there was incidences of bullying. I understood dealing with that. I guess what I'm going with this is wondering how is, why would you give somebody medication if they just are who they are? You know, I mean, is it just because they're psychologically so overwhelmed by the lack of acceptance?
Good question about why would medication be administered and what is that medication for? So, okay, we'll have Dr. Taylor answer that. Good question. Thank you, John, and thank you for waiting.
Something I wanted to mention, I like the indigenous approach. They call it two spirits.
Uh-huh.
They just accepted people.
Exactly.
Who they were.
Exactly.
And why that isn't enough. You know, is this a sociological issue, a psychological, a cultural, or is it, you know, actually got a medical reasoning behind it that would be of help other than just trying to help someone's psychology or, you know, their sense of mental health.
You're asking all the right questions, John. Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Taylor.
Yes, I'd love to answer that. So first of all, I'd like to say yes to all of those. I think medication does help treat the spirit, the physical, the psychological, and helps with acceptance. So I guess first I'd like to start by mentioning that there are several scientific studies with functional MRI. So what that means is they do brain scans on people when they're doing a task or being shown a picture or asked to answer some sort of question, and they see what areas of the brain lights up. So if we look at somebody who let's say someone who's assigned male at birth, so that means, you know, they're born, someone looks at the genitals and says, this is a boy, and says, go ahead and raise that kid as a boy. And then you take someone who is assigned female at birth, and when they're old enough to express who they feel they truly are as male, you look at both of their brains prior to any extra medication or hormone administration, and their brains will light up in the same way, in the same areas, which is different than someone who was born female or someone who identifies as female and feels has felt female their whole life, although they were assigned male at birth. So if that makes sense, but basically saying that it's not the hormones that cause the brain to light up differently. It's like the brains are actually structured differently, independent of the gender they were assigned at birth. So in my mind, giving hormones is helpful to the brain receptors because now they're going to be getting the hormones that they have been yearning for their whole life. So in the case of someone like Lily, who was assigned male at birth but always knew herself to be female and feels female, her brain most likely has receptors that are more attuned to female hormones or estrogen. Now, this is not something we ever going to use as a test. This is just some scientific studies when they've been looking at just doing studies looking at transgender brains. But to me, that gives some really good biological information. And then having said that, I feel like it doesn't really matter because if someone says they feel more comfortable with a hormone that their body does not produce in great quantity and that helps their quality of life, then that's enough for me. We do it within safe parameters. And what most people are hoping to see is not only the psychological advantages, which I can tell you are tremendous because when patients come in, even in those first few weeks or months before there are any physical changes, they tell me there's a lot of peace of mind. Sometimes there's really a evening out of any mood issues that they've been having or depression, anxiety. It kind of helps even out their, a lot of it is because they've been feeling uneasy for a long time. And so finally getting access to the treatment they want helps alleviate a lot of anxiety. And then generally what people are hoping for are the physical changes associated with the hormone they're getting. So in the case of testosterone, they're looking for hair growth and a deepening of the voice, and that helps them operate in society in a male role of how we tend to think and see males, and that helps them feel better. It can also be a safety issue. So someone who's a trans man, if they have a facial hair and someone doesn't see them as being visibly trans, they're probably less likely to get bullied. And similar for trans women, they're going to have some breast development, some softening of the skin, and changes that tend to make their appearance look more feminine. And, in our society, the way things are gendered and the way people are raised, if that person looks more feminine, they're less likely to have difficulties when they're out and about doing their everyday tasks, and less likely to get bullied, perhaps. That's our hope. For people who are what we call visibly trans, where you can look at them and say, oh, okay, this person's probably transitioning. Obviously, no one should be bullied, but they are definitely more at risk from people who feel that they have some sort of right to go up and say hateful and mean things to those people, even up into physical altercations. So the medications and subsequently surgeries are for peace of mind. They're for physical safety. They're for just them being able to look in the mirror. A lot of my patients tell me that they haven't looked in mirrors for years until they finally got on hormones and they are seeing the person that they always knew was inside. But when they went through adolescence that was innate to their genetics, it really was distressing because it wasn't kind of how they saw themselves. I think this goes back to how kids don't necessarily have the language because pre-adolescence, kids are only gendered because we do things, we put them in certain clothes, we cut their hair certain ways, we separate them in sports. But they're all basically physically the same. And so a kid can perhaps, especially a small child, have some sort of magical thinking that, well, I know they tell me I'm a girl, but when I grow up, I'm going to look like daddy someday, or even if they're thinking it that concretely. So then adolescence hits, and that's when we see a lot of kids suddenly have a lot of that distress. And I think that really is mirrored by, supported by what Lily went through, because sometimes they don't know what that distress is exactly. They don't have the language. And then when they finally kind of figure it out. They've been working through it for years. It's new news to friends and family. But, you know, getting the proper treatment, and generally that is with medication and a social transition, can really help relieve a lot of that distress.
And what I have experienced and what I've seen is, you know, when people talk about, you know, is this a mental illness issue? And my response is, I don't see that. You know, when people talk about, you know, the increased suicidality rates and those types of things of transgender kids and people, for me, in our experience, that's because of how society treats them, the depression and the mental health issues that they have. It's not because of their identity. It's because of how society treats them based on their identity in public. So I would want to make that clear as well. And when Dr. Taylor talks about transgender people that, you know, may not be passing, and that you may tell that they're transitioning, what I've seen and been tracking as well is this whole focus on transgender, especially trans women, causes more cis women harm than it does trans women, because people are trying to figure out who's
trans. They're trying to identify.
And if there's a cis woman that doesn't look the way that they think they should look as a woman, they're the ones being interrogated. They're the ones being chased out of the bathrooms. So this is, again, when Dr. Taylor talks about, you know, this isn't just another way to control women's bodies. This is having a bigger impact on cis women than it is on trans women when it comes to bathrooms and those issues.
Well, we've seen that with Olympic sports. We've seen that with global sports, where women have been misidentified as transgender women or the wrong sex, and then have really been ostracized and humiliated. And and the other thing is that it points out the abuse that many women have gone through, for instance, in gymnastics,
With Larry Nassar.
Where they're being sought for whether or not this is an excuse to use for abuse against them, for molestation.
Right.
This is just craziness. It's just craziness.
Yeah.
When all of this was going on, how did you and your wife and Lily make it through this piece? Where did you find your support here?
With each other, with our families, with support groups. I'm now a board member with the Gala Pride and Diversity Center. You know, they were a lifeline. You know, getting to know the community and getting to know that there were support groups for kids out there to go and be a part of. And you know, learning about all the different agencies across the state for knowledge and for information and for support.
Hey, Chris.
Yes.
It's Brad here in the studio. I'm glad we can hear each other.
Finally.
Finally. John did call back in with a couple of other observations, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Garrison Keillor, when presented with this question years ago, said, well, we just don't, you know, talking about bathrooms and all of the tropes that they use, because we just don't look, you know, so we don't care who's in the bathroom with us. As long as we're not looking, it doesn't really matter, which I thought was kind of smart. But he also says, isn't it also about people just minding their own business and letting people be who they are, right?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Would be nice, but it... wanted to say thank you for John for being an engaged listener, and I wanted to make sure his observations got re-injected into the conversation.
That's great. And if you want to be an engaged listener, you can call us at 805-781-3875. I'm sure that Trevor and Dr. Taylor would be more than willing to answer your questions. Where are things now? You're doing this education. Are you feeling like it's starting to land with people, that they're starting to come away with, wow, I didn't know that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating. What are some of the
questions that you're getting asked by parents that you didn't think you would be asked?
Well, I'll talk about I met with one of our school board directors yesterday and had coffee. And this is a person that has voted against our daughter, but has had some real kind of emotional confliction about doing that. So I met with them. We had coffee and just to have a conversation, because I'm willing to talk to anybody. Because to me, it's all about creating a dialogue.
Yeah.
And they're concerned, you know, on the bathrooms. And so I talked to them about our experience that when Lily first started using the locker rooms at school for PE, one of the girls approached her. You know, the school didn't really get the girls together and say, hey, this is what's happening and let's have a discussion. One of the girls approached her on the field with the Matt Walsh question, how do you define a woman, you know, kind of antagonistically. They started a dialogue. Lily turned it into a conversation. The school, the teachers and the administration saw it happening and saw that it was constructive, so they let it continue. The rest of the girls came in and joined. They all sat down and they had a conversation. And by the end of the conversation, one of the girls asked Lily, how would you feel if we used a different row in the locker room to change in? And of course, Lily was like, you should do whatever makes you feel comfortable. And when I told the board member, the school board member, this, she was like, had the impression that there was just a big square room with lockers on the outside wall and you were in an open space.
Right.
It's like, no, there's rows of lockers. So there's, I don't know, five or six different rows that people can change in. And in the girls' locker room at the high school, there is no assigned locker. You have a loose lock. So you can go and use any lock or, you know, locker that you want to. So all the girls would use a different row to change it if they felt uncomfortable. But at the end of the year, the girl that first approached our daughter was talking to the administrator about something else and talked to them and said, you know what, I was wrong. Lily's chill. Because they had gotten to know her and they had talked to her and they had a conversation. Any kid that has gotten to know our daughter realizes that she's not a threat and she's not in there to do anything. She times herself on how quick she can get in and out of the locker room. Locker rooms and bathrooms are the most dangerous place for transgender people there is. They don't want to be in there. They want to get in, get out. You know, they're going to go use the restroom and get out. So it was astonishing when the accusation was made at the school board meeting, because it's like, this is not reality. And what had happened, it was after school, before track practice, our daughter went in to use the restroom because the locker room is the safest place to do that for her, because there's an adult monitor in the locker room that watches the kids and makes sure, you know, nothing bad happens. When she was leaving the bathroom stall, she saw some of her friends on the sprinting crew and talked to them briefly, asked them a couple questions and left. Didn't even know, doesn't look up to see who else is there. Didn't even know this other child was there. So it was, it's always interesting the perceptions that people have in the process as well.
Yeah. And the fact that it would carry so far.
Right.
It's more than unfortunate.
Yeah. So, it, you know, the school board member was like, oh, I didn't realize that. And I was like, yes. And I, as I've talked to even the parent of the child, of another child that spoke, that their daughter changes in their car instead of the locker room, which to me is like, I don't get that. You've got windows in a car.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's so much exposure there. I don't, but I have my own vision of what that looks like. That's probably not her reality. I don't know if the car windows are tinted or if they've got a van or, you know, what that looks like.
Right.
But their parent was on a show, a radio show with Shannon Kessler, who's now running for state assembly, who's been really driving this anti-trans stuff in Aurora Grandy. When the host asked them a question about the bathrooms and the locker rooms, they didn't know how they work. They couldn't answer how they work. There was no curiosity to understand what the situation was and what the options are for any kid to have privacy when they're changing.
Yeah, and what the protections are that right. are in place, right? Not only for your daughter or for girls like Lily,
right.
but for the rest of the girls too. Some of the interesting things that I was reading that you'd given me ahead of time, you know, when we talk about transgender women, I was looking at the statistics, and the transgender women perform worse than cisgender women in tests measuring lower body strength, lung function, lower fat-free mass, weaker hand grip strength than transgender men. I mean, so the idea that just because somebody is a transgender woman that she's automatically going to win, you know, that's a myth too. I mean, the idea that just because you're transitioning or you at one point were male, that you're going to be taking all the trophies and it's an unfair fight, that doesn't exist either.
Yeah, it was interesting when the first teammate spoke about the locker room issue and feeling like Lily was watching her. There was so many people that wanted to speak that they reduced the amount of time from, you know, a 3-minute comment to a 1-minute comment. So she didn't get to complete all her comments. She came back the next school board meeting and talked about losing a race to Lily. And we were sitting there going, what is she talking about? She's a distance runner. Our daughter is a sprinter.
Right.
We didn't – it's like when did they run in a race together? The prior year, Lily's freshman year, this other girl's sophomore year, she ran a 400-meter race. So we looked back at the results of the – and it's like what race was that? It was a tri meet. Which means that there were only 3 schools there. It was during the week. The 400-meter race is at the end of the meet. The Oregon team, I mean, they were just demolishing these other schools, and it was the meet was running late. The other schools had kind of gotten on the bus to go back home because it was already late. So it was only the Oregon girls that ran in that race. Our best runners weren't on the team yet because they still were finishing their soccer season. Lily ran a 1:04 400-meter race. Not a great time. The other girl's time was 1:07.
But she wasn't a sprinter.
She wasn't a sprinter. She was just a distance runner. That was the first, to our knowledge, the first and only time she's run, you know, a sprint-type race. A 1:04 is not a good time. You know, CIF qualifying times are, you know, about a minute, and, you know, high 50s. So that the – when you hear these things, it's always dive in and understand the relativity.
Right, the context.
If she's worried about not winning a race with a 1:07, what – I don't know what race – the level of competition would be so low to have that be a winning time.
Right.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And I've seen that consistently when people talk about, you know, this transgender athlete won a long jump competition by 6 meters. That must have been really, really bad competition.
Yeah.
Because when that individual competed at CIF, there were people that were right there with her, you know, competing. So they are not dominating. You know, they use those words and people think that there's some extreme difference in results, and there's not. And in California, there's one example of a trans female athlete that has been very, very successful. There's one. And when it comes to sports, they trans athletes or trans students compete at such a lower rate because of these issues. There's very few of them. even if they would want to compete or had competed before, they don't want to go through what we have to go through to compete.
Yeah. If, you know, we've just got a minute or so, what in wrap up would you really want to make sure that listeners hear?
I think it's really have a dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, that when I talk to people, one of the questions I have is have you ever talked to somebody that's transgender?
Yeah.
For any length of time.
Or ask questions.
Had a meal, had coffee, had any curiosity. That's needed. And it's needed on both sides.
Yeah.
In the process to create a dialogue. Yeah. Let's stop, you know, talking separately and have discussions. You know, I've enjoyed talking to people that have different beliefs. We're not going to change each other's minds, but we understand that there's humanity on both sides.
And I want to thank both of you for coming today and for being so open in this dialogue. And the best to Lily, because she's a remarkable young woman. So thank
she
you.
Is a force of nature. Yeah. I've met her.
Absolutely. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Denise Taylor, HIV specialist and gender-affirming care provider, Trevor Norcross, father and advocate of transgender teen daughter Lily. Next week, please join KCBX for a holiday special, Jonathan Winters, A Christmas Carol, an updated version of a public radio traditional hosted by the late Susan Stramberg. I'm Chris Kington Barker for Central Coast Voices. Please thank you for joining us this past year, and the very best to you for the remainder of the holiday season. I hope you'll join us in 2026.